All right, y'all, Scott Horton here, and I got a great deal for you. Anyone who helps support this show with a $50 donation or more gets a copy of the brand new Rothbard book, Murray N. Rothbard book, of long-lost essays from 1967 and 68. It's entitled Never a Dull Moment, A Libertarian Looks at the 60s. Murray N. Rothbard, really Mr. Libertarian himself, on Vietnam, conscription, civil rights, LBJ and Nixon, and all kinds of great stuff from back during those times. Never a dull moment, and it's an exclusive. It's not available on Amazon yet. It's an exclusive, so far at least, for listeners of this show, so be the first to get it. Help support this show at the same time. Just go to scotthorton.org/donate, and again, anyone who sends $50 on this way, along with a mailing address, and I will get this book right to you. Thanks. All right, y'all. Welcome to the show. Scott Horton's show. I'm him. Check out the archives at scotthorton.org. More than 4,000-something interviews now, going back to 2003 there at scotthorton.org. Find all the newest ones at libertarianinstitute.org/scotthortonshow. The brand new thing. Check it out there, y'all. The Libertarian Institute. Libertarianinstitute.org/scotthortonshow. And you can follow me on Twitter at Scott Horton Show. Introducing Jason McLeod. He is a Quaker educator, organizer, and researcher. And he's the author of a book called Merdeka and the Morning Star, Civil Resistance in West Papua. And he joins me on the line by Skype from Tasmania right now. Is that right? Welcome to the show. How are you doing, Jason?
Very well, Scott. And hello, listeners. Yep, I'm here in Tasmania doing well. Cool. Good to be on the show.
All right. Well, say hi to my friend Ted down there. I'm sure you must know everybody on Tasmania. Well, Ted is my pal. So hey to Ted in Tasmania, too. All right. So now I have to admit, and I'm very sorry to say that it's true, that I have not read your book. What I've read is a very compelling review of your book at wagingnonviolence.org. And it's by a guy named Dale Hess. It was actually published last February here. Waging Nonviolence. Well, I need to make friends with those guys, whoever they are. Uncovering the secret 50-year history of struggle in West Papua. And I think I've seen Amy Goodman cover this back years and years ago. I don't know whether she's covered it recently or what, but I think I remember her covering this back in the days when she covered East Timor, that she talked about this. Right. And about, say, maybe even 10 years ago now, I read an article by John Pilger where he talked about the Rockefeller interests in working with the Indonesians and what they had done to West Papua. But other than that, I hardly know anything about it. And I get the idea that the reason I know so little about it is because of how important it is and that it's a direct inverse proportion or something like that. So I was hoping that you could fill us in and let us know. First of all, am I right that, as in the case of East Timor, that it's a different enough nationality, it counts as a different ethnicity, and so there's sort of a racial supremacy angle in the Indonesian colonization of West Papua? Well, I should say to the people, too, you can more or less picture the Dominican Republic and Haiti. It's the same kind of situation, right? A big, long island from east to west that's divided in half, right? And we're talking about the west half of it. Anyway, is that a good place to start, the kind of racial colonization tied in with the Indonesian rule over the people of West Papua?
Yeah, look, it's as good a place as any to start. And you're quite right. The Indonesian archipelago is just massive. You know, if you kind of imagine sort of Bangkok, it stretches all the way over, to New Zealand. It's an incredible archipelago nation of some, 17,000 islands. But yeah, look, the West Papuans are different historically and culturally and politically, from the rest of Indonesia. The West Papuans are Melanesian, so, black skin, curly hair, and the rest of the country are Asian, brown skin, straight hair. So they've kind of had different, there's different cultural background, but they've also had a different political experience as well. The you know, the whole nation was colonized by the Dutch. Well, the whole of Indonesia was colonized by the Dutch. And the Indonesians, you know, waged a war of independence against the Dutch, which was successful, and they gained independence. But the West Papuan experience of the Dutch, you know, was quite different, and the Dutch retained control of West Papua. And it wasn't until 1963, you know, a number of years later, that the West, that the Indonesians took over that part of the country.
Mm-hmm. And then, so it's really just all about stealing the minerals?
Yeah, look, that's another massive factor. West Papua is incredibly rich in natural resources. You know, they've got the largest individual taxpayer there, which is the Freeport McMoRan gold and copper mine. You know, I think they're based in your part of the world, in Texas.
Yeah, good old evil Jim Bob Moffat. We know him well here in Austin.
Yeah, that's him.
Yeah,
that's him. That's right. And then there's all sorts of oil and gas and, you know, other resources. There's massive land grabbing and palm oil in the south. So, yeah, resource grabbing is another huge factor that sustains the occupation. And then probably the third reason is that, you know, a lot of Indonesians consider West Papua part and parcel of Indonesia. You know, they say that it was previously all a Dutch colony, and therefore when the Indonesians kicked the Dutch out, West Papua should be part of Indonesia. West Papuans, of course, don't see it like that. But they're the three things that kind of drive the occupation, you know, the racial dimension, the economics, and in the way things, the political identity and the way Indonesians see that.
Yeah. Well, that last part sounds really important too, where well, like you're saying, 70,000 islands. I mean, at what point would anybody consider this a unified society, or, you know, was there some big threshold? I guess the Dutch had unified it under their rule, and so I see, yeah, there's a central government that lays claim to it. But then again, as far as the way it actually works, it's all very decentralized, right? And then, like you're saying, the racial difference, I could see that. It just gets twisted. Instead of saying, well, you know, they're different enough that maybe we should let them be independent, it's more like, nah, that just makes them inferior and an easier excuse to rule over them instead.
Yeah, there's a huge racial dimension. I mean, racism, it's kind of not even really discussed in Indonesia. But, you know, it's massive. And look, just one small example, the West Papuans have a really they've got a fabulous football team, soccer, we call it in Australia. And whenever they go to play in Indonesia, the folks in the crowds will, you know, call them monkeys and throw banana skins. You know, it's quite extreme. And then you see the way the police and the military repress the West Papuans. It's often motivated by strong kind of racial dislike. So yeah, it's a massive thing, but hardly acknowledged at all inside Indonesia.
Mm-hmm. And now, as far as, you know, their argument that they deserve to be independent versus just the mindset that no, of course not, on the part of, I think the way you were explaining it, the average Indonesian, not just the Indonesian state there, I mean, what is really to be done? Is there any kind of progress that even can be made in the near term, do you think?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, absolutely. You know, whilst you're saying that, you know, someone like yourself who's very well informed about what's going on around the world hasn't heard a lot about it, what's happened in the last 18 months has been more significant than what's happened in the previous 50 years. So, you know, similar to East Timor, when the various political groups came together and formed a coalition, the West Papuans have done the same. They've brought together three big coalitions, the West Papua National Coalition for Liberation, the National Federal Republic of West Papua, and the National Parliament of West Papua. These are three, you know, large resistance groups. They've all come together under an umbrella group called the United Liberation Movement for West Papua. So that unity inside the country and also outside with the representatives in the diaspora has been really significant. Now, when that happened in late 2014, you know, supported by the government of Vanuatu and the Pacific Conference of Churches, a number of other Pacific island nations started to step up. So you saw an example where the West Papuans got membership of the Melanesian Spearhead Group, which is a sub-regional forum in the Pacific made up of four countries, Vanuatu, Fiji, Papua New Guinea, the Solomon Islands, and also the pro-independence group in Kanaki or New Caledonia that's struggling against the French. So that grouping, the MSG, accepted the West Papuans. And what this did is basically created a permanent forum for dialogue and political negotiations with the Indonesians, who are now also members. So that's mm-hmm. been really significant. And then the West Papuans took their issue to the broader Pacific Island grouping, which is Melanesia, Polynesia, and Micronesia. And there's 16 countries, including Australia and New Zealand, that make that up. And the Pacific Island Forum has started to take this up. You know, they're saying to the Indonesian government now, look, you've really got to do something about these ongoing human rights violations. And then only last month, we saw seven nations, all Pacific Island nations, like Palau, Tuvalu, Vanuatu, Solomons, and others, pick up this issue in the United Nations. So, you know, as a result of this unity of different resistance groups and the diplomatic work that the leadership's doing, we're starting to see the struggle internationalized in a way that it's never happened before. And that's a really fascinating dynamic. And then as well as this diplomacy outside the country, you've got this amazing resistance inside the country. I mean, in this year alone, we've seen over 4,000 arrests of activists, you know, and this is just incredible. These sometimes they're young people, as young as 10, you know, right through to their elders, going out in the streets and demanding that they should have, you know, a referendum and a free and fair say in the outcome of their country. So there's been a lot of movement, and I think a lot of cause for hope.
Yeah, wow. 4,000 arrests. I mean, that's quite a clampdown, but I guess I see what you mean about the hope part being that they feel that's necessary at this point because that's how much pressure they're under. So, and as far as the international thing, I mean, I'd hate to see people rely on being saved by the UN somehow or something like that, but it sounds like really the UN and them are just responding to all this pressure from below. And so, yeah, if that can really help to gain independence, and preferably without the bloody crackdown that we saw in East Timor in the 90s, you know, maybe there could be a peaceful transition there to independence. Wouldn't that be something? Without a war.
It's certainly what the West Papuans hope for. But look, it's going to be a long and difficult struggle. There's no question about it. I mean, unlike pro-democracy struggles, you know, the Arab Spring and elsewhere, which are difficult enough to wage, these kind of anti-colonial or self-determination struggles are so much harder. You know, whether we're talking about West Papua or Western Sahara or Palestine, Tibet, you know, what have you, you've got to wage the struggle in three different areas. You know, you've got to wage it inside the occupied territory. Now, in this case, it's West Papua, but you've also got to wage it inside the territory of the occupier. In this case, it's Indonesia. And then you've got to target all the different countries that prop up the occupation, you know, whether it's, you know, Bob Moffat in the US, or whether it's, you know, police training, you know, from the Brits and the US and the Australians, or, you know, whatever other interests, you've got to target those as well.
Yeah.
So, yeah, it's incredibly difficult.
Yeah. Well, now, so elaborate more, would you, about the Americans here? You, in this review of your book, they mentioned the New York Agreement and the Kennedy administration and their complicity in, you know, the sham process basically for handing over West Papuan sovereignty to Indonesia in the first place. So this isn't just Freeport. This is Uncle Sam. And we all know that Jim Bob Moffat would probably be living under a bridge if it wasn't for the government handing him tax money all day, or holding, you know, natives at bayonet point while he steals their minerals or whatever it is. So, tell us as much as you can about the American role in the people of West Papua's problem here, if you could.
So you're a libertarian, and you don't believe the propaganda about government awesomeness you were subjected to in fourth grade. You want real history and economics. Well, learn in your car from professors you can trust with Tom Woods's Liberty Classroom. And if you join through the Liberty Classroom link at scotthorton.org, we'll make a donation to support The Scott Horton Show. Liberty Classroom, the history and economics they didn't teach you.
Yeah, great. Look, the U.S. has played a really important role in propping up the occupation and backing Indonesia. So, you know, you mentioned the 1962 New York Agreement. So the U.S., and you said the Kennedy administration, they helped broker this. So they brought together the Dutch and the Indonesians, and they hammered out this agreement. Now, there are a number of problems with the agreement, and the first was that West Papuans weren't even involved at all. They weren't even sitting around the table. So, you know, it was undemocratic right from the beginning. But there was one positive factor, and that was that the New York Agreement stipulated that there should be an act of universal suffrage, a referendum. Now, that was due to that ended up taking place in 1969. But by, you know, when the New York Agreement was hammered out, Sukarno was in power. By 69, Suharto was in power. And, you know, as you know, he came to power as a result of support of the CIA and a massive slaughter of anywhere between 500,000 and 2 million activists in Indonesia. So once Suharto was in power, he decided there's not going to be one person, one vote. That's just not going to happen. What he did is he rounded up 1,022 ordinary West Papuans, and in a process that took over a couple of months in different parts of the country, he basically had the military, you know, hold a gun to their head and said, vote for Indonesia, you know, or we're going to cut your tongues out. And this, I mean, he literally said that, and he said, you know, you go ask the U.S., you know, maybe they'll give you a place on the moon, but, you know, you're not going to be free. Now, what happened was, under this kind of duress, 100% of people said, right, you know, we're going to will be with Indonesia. They just felt like they had no choice. And there was no vote. There was no vote. Basically, they had a general make a speech and, you know, raise your hands if you agree with that. And this is happening in the context when anyone who disagreed was basically disappeared, and we had whole villages that were, you know, razed to the ground. The U.S. was supplying aircraft, kind of Bronco aircraft and other military equipment that was used to repress the West Papuans at that time. And then since, so that was, you know, kind of a big diplomatic push, repressive push that was carried out with lots of practical and tacit support from the U.S. And then, as you said, the economics have kicked in with companies like Freeport. But then you also, the U.S. is also involved in militarily backing Indonesia. So they train, they help train the police, they help train the military, and, you know, basically endorse what's turned out to be state-funded death squads in West Papua. You know, there's groups like Detachment 88, which gets a counterinsurgency police group. They get a lot of backing from the U.S. and the Australians and the Brits. And they're in West Papua kidnapping activists, disappearing them, shooting them, presiding over the arrest and torture of unarmed dissidents. So, yeah, the U.S. is involved pretty deep in helping maintain the occupation. And we don't hear anything about it because the Indonesian government doesn't let journalists in there.
Yeah. I wish I had reread that Pilger piece. I meant to try to find a moment to reread it about the Rockefellers' role in brokering some of this stuff back in the 1970s and how things were going to be there. Do you know about that?
Oh, yeah, look, a little bit. The interesting thing is, so after the Suharto came to power in 65, the Rockefellers, and, you know, people like Henry Kissinger as well, who are on the board of Freeport.
Who was Nelson Rockefeller's protege.
Yeah, yeah, that's right. So, look, they did a deal with the Indonesian government, and they were actually in West Papua preparing to open up this massive mine, you know, the world's largest gold and copper mine, in 1967. So that's 2 years before there was meant to be, you know, some kind of act of universal suffrage, which, as you know, we know never took place. So, yeah, they were right in there way before the whole question of sovereignty had ever been resolved. And that kind of massive economic wealth has helped maintain the occupation. And, you know, like, I've been there. I've been to that mine. I've been to the hotels where the U.S. expats stay. And, you know, you're still just full of a lot of U.S. advisors, government advisors, military advisors, private contractors. They're everywhere.
Sure. Well, and definitely back at that time, the State Department really was the Rockefeller Empire. In fact, it was built on Standard Oil's global corporate network that had preceded the American Empire. So when they finally needed a global State Department, the Rockefellers were like, hey, we have offices in all of these countries where you need to be. So the overlap was incredible, the way they worked together, and certainly especially back then too. So and you know, I think they didn't even know that there was ever anything immoral about hiring the U.S. government to use violent force to get their way on any issue in the whole world that they could think of. What, there's a bunch of curly-headed N-words in between them and some gold? Well, so have the CIA send in some guys with bayonets to solve the problem. Simple as that. What's the discrepancy here? You know, that's the way they look at it. Certainly. And so tell us more about this police state too, because we kind of glossed over that at the beginning. Was sort of the real point. 4,000 people rounded up. That doesn't sound like they're getting speedy trials and skilled public defenders here. And you talked about the secret police, and I guess there's the public police, but are we talking about straight up, you know, West Bank style military occupation by Indonesian troops at all times? Or is there any form of, you know, kind of sock puppet self-government representation, maybe more like the Gaza Strip, where they're really just trustees of the occupying power, but at least they're locals, that kind of thing? Or what's it look like?
Definitely. Look, it's that combination of hard and soft power, without a doubt. So yeah, you do have the police and the military as an occupying force, severely kind of clamping down on any sort of public dissent. But at the same time, as you say, you've also got West Papuans who are running day-to-day affairs of the country. But you know, that's kind of a really interesting dynamic as well, because the government, so there's two provinces in West Papua, which is one half of the island of New Guinea, I should say. So, you know, the eastern part is Papua New Guinea. That's been independent since 75. And then the western half is West Papua, controlled by the Indonesians. So there is these two provinces. You've got, Papuans, there's a Papuan governor, in power there. But, you know, what's interesting is he's increasingly, speaking out, and criticizing Jakarta, you know, who's 3,000 kilometers away. So, yeah, you do have that dynamic, but he's shadowed by a whole lot of military and police. It's kind of difficult to move. And, you know, then you've a lot of West Papuans put their faith in Jokowi. Joko Widodo is the current Indonesian president. They saw him as being a democratic reformer. Unfortunately, he's turned out to be no better than a lot of the previous Indonesian presidents. Human rights violations have increased in West Papua. You know, Jokowi said he would allow journalists to come in. That hasn't eventuated. He said he'd release political prisoners. That hasn't eventuated either. There's still, scores of political prisoners in West Papua. So I think we're starting to see a dynamic where a lot of people are recognizing that the conventional political processes put in place by the Indonesian government, things like special autonomy, just aren't working, and the demand for a referendum is becoming more and more strident every day.
Mm-hmm. So I'm interested in Moffat's minds over there. Are the people working them just slaves, or how many degrees above outright slavery are they living over there?
Yeah, that's interesting. So it was pretty bad right up until 2008. In 2008, because there was no independent union that was allowed, not just at the mine, but anywhere else in West Papua. But the Papuans got themselves together. They unified the highland workers and the island workers, and they formed an independent labor organization called Tongoi Papua. And they went on. It's incredible because the workforce was really divided. So they had very few opportunities to actually get together and organize. But what happened is they would come together every day for about 10 minutes at this tram terminal as they were waiting to be taken to different parts of the mine, the underground mine and the open cut mine. And they managed to get agreement to strike. They went on strike for about 4 days, and as a result of that, they won a 100% wage increase and got agreements to hire a lot more Papuan workers. And then they went on strike again in 2011. That went on for about 3 months and just the company lost tens of millions of dollars every day. And now some contractors are on strike again. So there's been a lot of agitation amongst the workers, and interestingly, the Papuan mine workers and the Indonesian workers are starting to collaborate a lot more. So, but yeah, look, the conditions are pretty bad. Lower paid workers, can barely get by. I can't remember the exact figure per month, but it's not a lot. And large parts of the population in Timika, which is the main town that services the mine, live in absolute poverty. And the tragedy there is the Amungme and the Kamoro, they're the two tribes who own the land around the mine, still see very little benefit. I mean, for the Amungme, that's their ancestral grandmother. And, you know, she's had her head cut off, and they're digging out the contents of her stomach, and they're dumping it into these rivers at the rate of 200,000 tons per day, and it's just smothering vast tracts of rainforest. So it's a pretty bad situation environmentally as well as from a labor and human rights point of view. And you've still got the Indonesian military and police who provide protection to the mine. And that's with, you know, the Freeport Moffat's still very involved with that. I saw figures the other day that, you know, the police get $10 million for lunch money, in inverted commas. And you've got kind of military generals that get direct cash payments to provide security.
So directly from Freeport-McMoran, you're saying?
Well, that's
or from the U.S.
The evidence suggests, that it's direct payments. Mm-hmm. It's still difficult for people to get in there. You know, you can't get journalists in there. There was a Guardian journalist that went in, a US reporter actually, who went in a couple of months ago, and there's going to be an article coming out in the Guardian any day now.
Oh, really?
But even she couldn't do that openly. So it's really difficult to get an exact picture of what's going on. But certainly our colleagues working in the mine say direct cash payments are still being paid to the police and the military there.
Man. So, yeah, I mean, you could see how it's going to be tough work no matter what. Poor people working in mines. That's the story of humanity. You do the best you can since, you know, the Bronze Age or whatever it is. On the other hand, if they had independence and if they had anything like local control, they might have a local horrible warlord who just takes over, but it seems like they would have a lot better shot at having something like a fair and equitable system or a chance on correcting whatever system tries to come up in place of Indonesian rule here. And then it's a question of, you know, yeah, it's tough work, but how do we compensate for that in terms of, you know, working hard to make sure that people are kept safe first and foremost while they're doing it and this kind of thing. And as long as you got, you know, the people who own the place are based out of Austin, Texas, and the only accountability are the local cops who are the representatives of an occupying foreign power, there's no opportunity for accountability whatsoever for what happens to these people. That's why I assume the worst without knowing. I just figure, what hope do they have if they can't talk back or else, right?
Yeah, and that's why international solidarity is so valuable, and that's why, you know, this conversation that we're having right now is so important. You know, the Papuans are really looking out to folks in the US and elsewhere to stand with them, to tackle, Freeport's involvement, to look at the way the U.S. is training and arming the Indonesian police and military, you know, not for the U.S. and people in the U.S. to save them, not at all. You know, the Papuans are the ones driving their struggle, and they're the ones that are going to ultimately liberate their country. But solidarity in places like the U.S., targeting the way the U.S. props up the occupation, is absolutely vital. And I look to the next couple of years with hope that we'll start to see, you know, that kind of international solidarity emerge.
All right. Now, Merdeka, that means independence?
Freedom.
That means freedom.
Yeah, it means freedom. But, you know, it's one of these really interesting words, and there's lots of nuanced understandings about it. But look, the Papuans want to be independent, but they also want to make sure that they've, they can maintain control of their natural resources, that they can speak their own language, that they can, practice their own cultural identity and all of that kind of stuff. So, yeah, it means freedom, but in a very rich and deep sense.
All right, good deal. Well, that's the book, Merdeka and the Morning Star, Civil Resistance in West Papua. And that's Jason McLeod. Thanks very much for coming on the show. I really appreciate it.
Thanks for having me, Scott. And thanks, listeners, too.
All right, y'all. Check out the archives at libertarianinstitute.org/Scott Horton Show. Help support at libertarianinstitute.org/support. And follow me on Twitter @Scott Horton Show. Thanks, you guys. Hey, all, Scott Horton here. It's always safe to say that one should keep at least some of your savings in precious metals as a hedge against inflation. And if this economy ever does heat back up and the banks start expanding credit, rising prices could make metals a very profitable bet. Since 1977, Robertson Roberts Brokerage, Inc. has been helping people buy and sell gold, silver, platinum, and palladium, and they do it well. They're fast, reliable, and trusted for more than 35 years. And they take Bitcoin. Call Robertson Roberts at 1-800-874-9760 or stop by rrbi.co. Hey, all, Scott here. On average, how much do you think these interviews are worth to you? Of course, I've never charged for my archives in a dozen years of doing this, and I'm not about to start. But at patreon.com/Scott Horton Show, you can name your own price to help support and make sure there's still new interviews to give away. So what do you think? 2 bits? A buck and a half? There are usually about 80 interviews per month, I guess, so take that into account. You can also cap the amount you'd be willing to spend in case things get out of hand around here. That's patreon.com/Scott Horton Show. And thanks, y'all.
I love Bitcoin, but there's just something incredibly satisfying about having real, fine silver in your pocket. That's why commodity discs are so neat. They're 1 ounce rounds of fine silver with a QR code on the back. Just grab your smartphone's QR reader, scan the coin, and you'll instantly get the silver spot price in Federal Reserve notes and Bitcoin. And if you donate $100 to the Scott Horton Show, he'll send you one. Learn more at facebook.com/commoditydiscs. Commoditydiscs.com.